during the COVID pandemic, a lot of people would say things like, "We're all in this together," or "We're all in the same boat." As the months drug on, people began to change that second adage to, "We're not all in the same boat, but we're all in the same storm." I think of adversity a lot like the metaphoric storm. We all face adversity. The question becomes how much and how capable are we to deal with the trials that life throws at us? What about our patients? How equipped are they to deal with chronic illness, health systems, or treatment options, to name a few? Today, on Journeys to Medicine, the Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine Synapse explores adversity. Jordan Salvato is a member of the class of 2026. His journey has taken him from childhood in Missouri to theology school in Texas to a post-bac at Columbia University to a Midtown Manhattan Chick-fil-A. You weren't expecting that last one, were you? In Act 1 of our program, let me introduce you to the Ivy League Chicken Salesman.
Let me take you back to a magical year. The year in which the iPhone 6 was available, Taylor Swift was on her 1989 tour, and Drake dropped the ultra banger Hotline Bling. The year is 2015. I'm a little bit younger, have less of the beard, but essentially the same person. I had just finished my undergraduate degree, which was in theology, the study of metaphysics, religion, philosophy. And along the course of my undergraduate career, I realized that I wanted to serve people in a bigger capacity in the field of medicine. And so in order to make this dream come true, I had to apply for a post-baccalaureate program. Now, post-baccalaureate program is a program that is streamlined to help people do a career switch. So I had to take all the sciences and preparation for the MCAT and facilitate my way into a medical school. So as I am applying, I gain acceptance into Columbia University in New York City, and I'm overjoyed. The thought of making an Ivy League education come true sustained me. So I moved up to New York in 2015, and boy, was New York a lot. I loved it. It was chaotic. It was wonderful. There's lots of people. And I was also studying something that was so different than what I had been studying. All the science courses were now being taught to me in such a deep capacity, which meant that a lot of my time was spent studying on the train, learning physics and calculus and statistics, which, yes, I'm sure I remember some of it somewhere. But what I wanted to talk about is that after my first few semesters at Columbia, I had maxed out my federal loans, which means that I was out of money. I couldn't afford to continue classes. I had $27 to my name, which means that I had to take a year off, at least, and begin working. And if you know anything about New York, you know that rent is due first of the month, and I'm not particularly fond of not having a place to sleep. So I did what I had to do, and I began applying for jobs that would take me and begin my working career in New York City. And the first job that I was accepted was as a Chick-fil-A worker in Midtown Manhattan. So yes, I became an Ivy League chicken salesman. And you must be thinking, wow, that's so glamorous. He gets to put on the red polo, those black pants, and those non-slip shoes. Well, it's not. In fact, it was awful. You see, in Midtown Manhattan, it's a population of 1.6 million. And all the financial buildings in the area give lunch at the exact same time. So between the hours of 11 and 3, there was a nonstop, endless line of people all hungry for chicken. And that means me and my red shirt, black pants, and my bachelor's degree in Ivy League education was serving all of them. We serve anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 people every day. And people get pretty feisty for their chicken. And the Chick-fil-A sauce, for sure. I served thousands of people daily. I said my pleasure probably 10,000 times a week. And there was a lot of other things that I had to deal with, as well as people bombarding me with harassment for not being fast enough, complaints from visitors, tourists, even celebrities came in to buy chicken from us. And if I were to miss a single shift, I would not have been able to afford rent. Amidst all of this, the worst part of it was that I felt like an utter failure. Yes, that's a cow pun. I was educated, older than most of my fellow employees, and had dreams of becoming a doctor. So I had to ask myself a question. Why should I try and climb this mountain that was before me? This enormous mountain of chicken. I think the best way to illustrate the point I want to make today is through a simple story. So please indulge me for a few moments. There once was a young man who had made a lot of money on Wall Street. But over the course of a few months, he began to make some bad decisions and began to lose his wealth. The love of his life left him and his family turned their backs on him. And in order to solve the problems that he began to search for solutions and he wanted to find wisdom. And in order to do so, he realized that he would have to find where most people hide their wisdom, which is on the top of high places. So he began to travel and look for the highest point, and if you will indulge me for a few moments, he came to find that atop of Mount Scranton, the highest point in the world, that there was wisdom that could help him. So he travels to Scranton, and he finds, by talking to the local people, that there is a guide that will take him to the very top of the mountain. So he hires the guide, and they begin their ascent up this mountain. The first day goes by. Not a single word was said by the guide. The second day goes by, and the traveler is feeling a little bit more tired, but not a single word is said by the guide. On the third day, they continue their climb. The packs are getting a little bit heavier. The traveler is getting a little bit more tired, and the guide comes to him and says, "Why do you climb this mountain?" And the traveler responds by saying, "I have to get away from all the things that are going on in my life." And that was it. They continue their climb, and as they get closer and closer to the summit, the weather begins to chill. There's rain that becomes snow, and it gets colder and colder, and the cold seeps into the bones of the traveler. But he doesn't hear from the guide. Another day goes by, and the seemingly endless cold continues, and then the guide comes to him and says, "Why do you climb this mountain?" And the traveler, shivering and shaking, says, "Because I need to get to the top. I need to get off this mountain." And they continue their climb. A few more days go by and they're reaching the summit, and the traveler is beginning to feel overjoyed that he can almost make it to the top and he would find the wisdom that he was looking for. And then they get to the summit after a few more days. The traveler looks around, expecting to see a temple, a book, a guru, anything up there that would help him in his situation. But he doesn't see anything. He looks around and all he can see is the sea of clouds below him. Defeated, the traveler goes and he sits down and hangs his head sorrowfully. The guide walks over and sits next to him and asks, "Why do you climb this mountain?" The traveler doesn't have an answer. The guide begins to speak and says, "I've asked you why you climb this mountain 3 times. The first time you told me because you had to get away from what was plaguing your past. You were climbing this mountain for who you were. The second time I asked you, why do you climb this mountain?" And the traveler said, "Because I want to get off of this mountain, because I'm cold. You are traveling up this mountain because of who you are. And now I ask you, why do you climb this mountain?" "It's because of who you would become." The traveler and the guide sit and watch the tranquil sun rise above the clouds. When faced with this giant mountain of chicken before me, I had to ask myself, why do I climb this mountain? Because adversity is a part of all of our lives. The sun doesn't always shine for us. People leave. Loved ones hurt us. There's always a million reasons not to do something. But your answer to that question of why you climb that mountain is important. I think it's a little bit unfair that you know the rest of the story, but when I ask myself that amidst this giant mountain of chicken, I realize that I was climbing for the person that I would become. That I would one day stand atop that mountain, gaze upon the tranquil sun rising and the clouds, and be a future physician. That I would one day be able to be a guide for somebody who is facing a seemingly impossible mountain. So let me be your guide today for whatever mountain is before you and ask you, why are you climbing this mountain? Is it for the person you were? Is it for the person you are? Or is it for the person you will become?
When I sat down with Kevna Joshi, she mentioned she was from Nashua, New Hampshire, and added, a town that not many people have heard of. I explained that a common descriptor I use for myself is a misplaced Vermonter, which led to a discussion of which state had a more quaint state capital. Kevna's journey from New England to GCSOM ran through Dartmouth and encompasses a much broader story of success. In Act 2, Kevna Joshi with From Speechlessness to Eloquence.
Today, I'd like to share a story that holds a very special place in my heart. This story has taught me several lessons, both about life and even about myself. It all started for me at a very young age. I thought that having a speech problem was going to destroy my entire future. In fact, some of my earliest memories of medicine as a profession revolve around visiting a speech therapist when I was just 5 years old. I was diagnosed with an extreme level of stuttering, a speech pathology known as verbal blocks. No matter how hard I tried to push words out, especially those that started with vowels, they just stayed lodged in my throat. The neurologist told me that my brain worked faster than my vocal cords and that my voice could not keep up with what my brain had already previously processed. The only people that I could comfortably communicate with were my parents, other family members, and sometimes my closest friends at school. But my speech with all other people was hindered. After visiting my first few speech therapists, they all told my parents that my childhood development would be extremely slowed. They told me that first, my social communication with my peers would decline, and then told me that my academic performance would later deteriorate, affecting my professional career and my entire future. My parents were heartbroken when they heard this from the speech therapists, but they absolutely refused to believe it. They knew that this couldn't be my future, and instead of giving in, they decided to fight with me. Shortly after, we discovered that singing could help to heal and possibly reduce the severity of this condition. My grandma, who I lovingly call Bamaba, started teaching me bhajans, a word for native spiritual songs that became part of our daily prayers. The more I sang, the smoother my speech became. In addition to singing, I continued speech therapy for more than 7 years after this, with a speech therapist who also believed in me and taught me advanced speech techniques like sliding through each word to overcome my difficulties. But I think most importantly, the constant support from my family brought me through to the very end. When my parents were first told that my speech issues would affect me and my future, they drew me a wheel of encouragement on the door of my bedroom with all my positive qualities instead of my negative qualities like my speech difficulty. They pointed out that I'm kind, I'm jumpy, I have a really funny laugh, I love to talk to others, and I love to cuddle. But we didn't put down any of my negative qualities, even though my speech difficulty affected me each and every day. Every time I spoke to somebody, I wondered, am I going to be able to make it through this sentence? Am I going to be able to make it through this word? But most importantly, am I going to be able to get through this day? Will I be able to make it to the next grade? Are people going to judge me? Being in the psych block right now, I guess you could say I almost had agoraphobia or social anxiety disorder. I was too embarrassed to go in public or even speak in front of people for fear of not being able to make it through that sentence. And it really started affecting me mentally, physically, emotionally. And I really wasn't sure if I'd be able to go on in life that way. But the way that my parents encouraged me, the way that my speech therapist encouraged me and told me that I'd be able to get through it if only I focused on my positive qualities, continued pushing through the techniques that I'd learned and continued singing while still being able to communicate with my friends, that I would be able to get through this. Every day when I woke up, I would see that wheel of my positive traits, and focusing on those traits helped me completely change my whole perspective on life. Ultimately, my speech therapist's advanced techniques, my family's unwillingness to give up, my own dedication, and the musical ear that I developed ultimately helped me overcome the problem. I wanted to tell this story to tell people that no matter how tough your problem is, it is always possible to get through it. Despite my speech problems in the past and how much they impacted me, I gave a TED Talk. I am recording this podcast, and I now regularly partake in public speaking, which used to be one of my biggest fears. Changing the way that you see your problems and seeing yourself as somebody who can adjust and be flexible to changing situations rather than accepting who you are can ultimately grant you victory over your own self and your internal conflicts, and can really help you win yourself over and even win over others. I really hope that this story has been inspiring for you and can help you overcome any troubles and hardships that you may be going through. Thank you so much for listening today.
Vincent Scalcione is a member of the class of 2026. His journey has been one of ideology more so than geographic. A native of Binghamton, New York, Vincent studied at SUNY Geneseo prior to coming to medical school. However, it was an opportunity to shadow a physician working with stroke patients that set him on the path to medicine. The resiliency and dedication the patients put toward getting their lives back made Vincent reflect on his own path. In Act 3, Adversity and Allergies, a Type 1 Hypersensitivity to Self-Advocacy.
Today, I want to talk to you about my food allergies. I understand that in terms of adversity, this may be perhaps not as devastating or daunting as someone going through depression, cancer, or losing a loved one. However, this is important to me in terms of what I took away from it and how it has shaped me as a person over the years. I also want to preface that my food allergies are not as life-threatening as they are for some, but they are bad enough if that I ingest tree nuts, seafood, or certain fruits and vegetables, I will need to take a Benadryl or two to alleviate an insufferable itchy throat sensation. As one would guess, I was never particularly fond of having food allergies. However, I was not bothered in the sense that I would never be able to enjoy the foods I was allergic to. Rather, I felt guilty that I was inconveniencing others when I had to inquire about what was in a dish or dessert. Imagine being in a line getting food, and when you get to the front, you are holding everyone up because you have to ask the food server what is in that dish. Most often, the server does not know off the top of their head, and they have to go back into the kitchen or go see the chef. Although most people would have no problem waiting, I created an illusion mentally that I was being a nuisance to others by asking for my well-being. Plus, as a little kid, when there is dessert being served, you really have a hard time saying no to those delicious cupcakes and cookies. When I was young, my parents did try numerous things to help me alleviate my fears. For instance, my parents always reminded me to ask before you eat, and if I did not, they would get upset with me, understandably so. Often, they would ask for me when we went out to some food venue, whether that would be at a restaurant, we were ordering dessert at, or a Cub Scout cookout. I was too embarrassed to admit that I had allergies myself. I just felt bad for inconveniencing others. However, when I was on my own, such as at a friend's birthday party, I never spoke up. I ate the food and accepted whatever risk I was taking. This was not mentally healthy, as I had always felt on the verge of having a reaction, even though I knew I was not symptomatic. I would be sitting there eating a bite of cake and thinking, is my tongue itching or am I just imagining it? And then I would secretly scurry off to the bathroom to wash my mouth, just in case. My mom eventually got irritated that I neglected to speak up for myself. After I got back from events where I had been on my own, she would ask me, did you ask before you ate that cookie? And I would always say, I forgot, even though that was not the real reason. At the time, I was like, what's the big deal? Nothing happened. But deep down, I knew that I was really doing a disservice to myself, and there could be consequences. I have to give a lot of credit to my mom because she got fed up with my risky behavior and bought me a custom allergy bracelet. I'll never forget it. It was a silver bracelet that had a medical symbol on the one side and my allergies in dark black print on the other. She told me that this was my symbol for reminding me of my allergies and that I did not have the excuse anymore, that I just forgot. And this worked for a while. I would speak up in school and other places that served food. But as I went into middle school, I stopped wearing it every day and relapsed into my old habits. This was most likely because I felt dumb wearing it. It was not particularly cool for me to wear an allergy bracelet, and I did not want other kids to be asking, why are you wearing that thing? And if you know middle schoolers, they just want to be cool and be part of the in crowd, and I was definitely included in that. After several years of getting away with it and not asking, my actions eventually caught up to me one cool February day in middle school. My friend had a sugar cookie that he did not want, and so I was like, I'll take it. After all, it just looked like the normal cookie. It passed the eye test. I was completely unaware that the dough part of the cookie contained almond paste. I quickly ate it, but a few seconds later, my tongue and throat felt unbearably itchy. I chugged two chocolate milks and tried to wash out my mouth, but the damage was done. They led us outside for recess, and I desperately tried to ignore the pain, but it was getting worse and worse. Finally, I gave in and ran inside straight to the nurse's office. I was injected with an EpiPen there. Shockingly, a lockdown and an ambulance were both called. Physically, I was okay, but emotionally, I was embarrassed at all the commotion I caused. As I sat in the nurse's office and the EpiPen wore off, I looked over and noticed the cupboard where the nurse had gotten the EpiPen from. I saw that there were 5 or 6 EpiPens in there with some of my classmates' names written on the box. I had this aha moment where I realized I wasn't alone in my allergies. Seeing those names made it personal. I knew some of those students. And that's the first step to adversity, to realize you aren't special. And you're not alone. This incident caused me to reevaluate my struggle with allergies. I realized that had I been proactive about the situation, I would have saved myself a lot of embarrassment. More importantly, I realized how fortunate I was to have received treatment so quickly. I decided to finally put into practice ask before you eat. I slowly became comfortable in alerting others about my allergies at weddings, restaurants, and cookouts. Having allergies has also been a blessing in a lot of ways. I was never really a super shy person, but constructive confrontation was something that I struggled with as I got older. And I sort of realized that my mom buying me the allergy bracelet was not only a way for me to stay safe, but as a way to advocate for myself and others. For example, as an organic chemistry tech teaching assistant during my undergraduate years, students sometimes asked me to discuss an issue in class or extend a deadline with a professor, and I felt comfortable being that liaison and an advocate for those students. Having allergies has also boosted my self-confidence. As a camp counselor, I sometimes noticed other counselors were too lenient with our campers, such as letting them climb on inappropriate areas of the playground. I then politely asked my cohorts to not allow this behavior since it was unsafe. In both scenarios, repeatedly disclosing my allergies prepared me to speak up in a professional setting when I felt it was necessary. Additionally, it has reinforced a notion in me to ask when unsure. Again, during my undergraduate years, I worked as a certified nursing assistant. Even though I had been trained, I often had lots of questions, and I was unafraid to ask when I was not sure what to do. Most of the time, people were willing to check things out for me and assist me in my duties. Asking a question was not putting a burden on someone. It was a sign of maturity and resourcefulness. Lastly, having allergies has shaped me to be a cautious, detail-oriented person. Habitually reading food labels and talking to cooks has instilled a natural tendency to ask questions and analyze the situation before making a decision. Overall, through the positive habits I've developed because of them, I no longer view my allergies as an annoyance. They have equipped me with lifelong skills for the professional world, and most importantly, have helped shape my personality.
Voices you hear on Journeys to Medicine are those of the members of the Synapse Medical Humanities and Storytelling Club at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Thank you to Jordan, Kevna, and Vincent, along with the Synapse Executive Board, who you'll meet a little later this season. And thank you to the leadership and my fellow faculty at GCSOM. I'm your producer and host, Dr. Ian McCoug. Join us next time for more Journeys to Medicine.